Science, and welcome to episode 11 of Sicko Mode. I am Siang.
And I am Joe.
So, today we have an actual extra special guest, Vijay Prashant.
That's a bit harsh on other guests.
They were all very special in their own way, yeah. But Vijay is, you know, he's a big dog. He's a leading internationalist Marxist, author of like 25 books or something, including Red Star of the Third World, the most recent one. All around, great comrade.
Yeah, and he has an upcoming book called Washington Bullets, which looks like it's going to be really good.
Yeah.
But yeah, we were really lucky to have him on. I first met him last summer at Oxford Transformed, the local Transformed event, which we talk a little bit about on the podcast. But he's an incredibly generous and really useful intellectual voice right now, and certainly the kind of things he prescribes, like organizing for power, feel like a glass of water when the left is deeply thirsty.
Yes.
And I think it's really good to have a kind of long form interview with him.
Long form.
And hopefully we'll have him back. He agreed to be our internationalist man of mystery and to be part of the Sicko Mode
official team.
Retinue. Yeah, the team. Yeah. I've been reading a lot of that Thomas Cromwell book, so I'm just thinking about the court and the team.
Anyway.
The party.
Let's get to it.
Yeah.
Welcome to you.
At the beginning, we just wanted to kind of say hi and ask how you're doing and how your quarantine is going and where are you in the world and that kind of thing.
Well, you know, tomorrow is... Well, firstly, thank you for inviting me. It's very kind of you.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I want to say that this quarantine is not easy for most people. For socialists, it's very difficult.
Yeah.
Basically, solitude is difficult for socialists. That's a basic thing. We are made to be out there amongst people, giving relief, building for tomorrow, and so on. For us to be inside four walls, it's not a normal state, you know.
Yeah.
Tomorrow, we are speaking today, tomorrow is Ho Chi Minh's 130th birthday.
Yes.
And when he was in prison, he wrote a poem, and I'll share it with you because, you know, I'm surrounded by Ho Chi Minh's texts now because I'm making a selection of his works for Leftward Books.
Oh.
So in his prison, he wrote, "Everyone has his own stove and a few earthen pots for cooking rice and vegetables and brewing tea. All day, without interruption, the place is filled up with smoke." Oh. That's how I feel.
Yeah, it's very apposite. And in a lot of the tricontinental newsletters, there's often poetry or particularly interesting pieces of research, right? Certainly in quarantine, I felt very... I mean, sometimes it's cold comfort. It's not exactly comfort food, the newsletter.
Yeah.
But a lot of the like the Mao poem on the plague recently was particularly like it gave one a sense of perspective, and it, you know, and also the depth of the crisis maybe. But certainly those newsletters, I think a lot of people have been enjoying them.
Well, I'm very glad about that because you know, the newsletter is an essential part of our institute. And it goes every week. It goes to a large number of people. And there are perhaps three elements to the newsletter. You know, one is the element of the text, which is constructed around what we think is something important to share with people. You know, it can be a theme that we're interested in sharing with people. It can be several themes. But then the two other parts are equally important. You know, there are three legs to it. The text, the poetry, and the art. Now, from my perspective, as far as Marxists are concerned, as far as socialists are concerned, there is something very difficult to convey to people. Firstly, the seriousness of our commitment to making the world a better place. To convey seriousness is difficult because people generally want to take your seriousness and dismiss it as perhaps utopian, naive, or, you know, earnest. These are some of the ways in which people dismiss seriousness. You know, I don't think we are naive. I think we have a very hard-headed understanding of the world.
Yeah.
I don't think we're earnest. I think we are just committed to something. We love human beings. I mean, I have an abiding faith in the in the real passionate good nature of human beings. So I don't think that's earnestness. That's a belief in humanity. So how do you convey this sense of commitment? Mm. And I think that poetry and art are an excellent way to convey this, you know, essential, very hard as a diamond feeling. That's because poets essentially distill feelings. You know, they take a whole bunch of text and then they cut it down to the barest of feeling. Mm. And I think it's so important for people to be, in a way, shocked by the, you know, the nakedness of feeling which a poet can convey. You know, James Joyce in Dubliners constructs his stories around the concept of the epiphany. You know, you're reading a story, you're reading a text, you're entering people's lives, and then suddenly there's a moment where you go, ah, okay, I get it. It doesn't all wrap up together because human history is not capable of wrapping everything with a bow. It doesn't wrap up together. Contradictions don't work like that. But there's got to be a moment for humans where we go, ah, I get a sense of, you know, of the feeling. And so that's the reason why art and poetry are so essential. It's not just to have art and poetry, you know, there's a theory behind it.
And you can see why as well this theory of poetry would appeal to socialists and communists, because this idea of the epiphany, as an idea of where something touches you in such a way that it surprises you out of the quotidian, right? That's probably the kind of thing that a lot of leftists were hoping would come out of some of our worst crises. In particular, this one, a lot of people were saying things have gotten so bad now that surely this will be a kind of an epiphany, like en masse, an epiphany for new frontiers of collective endeavor, like might grow out of this kind of realization. And actually, your newsletters also talk a lot about the kind of global response to the crisis and what is happening globally, which is a kind of frontier that a lot of people don't often think about. Like, even in socialist circles in the UK, it's often very domestically restricted. But I was wondering if for our listeners you could describe how you make sense of the kind of global response to the pandemic.
You see, there's a problem that not only in Europe but in North America the left faces, and this is a problem in a way where the alternative has been taken away from people's imagination. Let's say that from the 1950s onward, you know, was it Hungary in 1956 or McCarthyism in the United States that killed off or penalized the left for the existence of the socialistic parts of the world? You know, socialists tried to wash themselves of actually existing socialism, saying that's not what it is. You know, we'll do something else. This habit in the North Atlantic was very strong, this disavowal from actual socialist experiments. So you see that in the realm of theory, when Perry Anderson writes about the break between theory and praxis in Western Marxism, says that, you know, we are about theory. We don't really see the possibility of praxis, this, you know, fundamental divorce from the praxis in the North Atlantic states, and then, of course, with the actually existing socialist experiments. A very great break.
Yeah.
This break didn't happen in the rest of the world. So in the rest of the world, because socialist experiments took place in the realm of necessity, you know, in poor countries. Even in the Tsar's empire, that was a poorer country than Germany. You know, you expected the revolution in Germany. It happened in the Tsar's empire. Then it happens in China, an extraordinarily poor country. It happens in Cuba and Vietnam. These are all poor countries, you know. Poor countries made the leap towards something like socialism. So the Western left, by and large, on the one side, which had sort of surrendered to reality and said, you know, we are going to build theory, we have cut ourselves off from practice, denigrated these socialist experiments, set them aside, said that they're not real or they're Stalinist or whatever it might be. You know, this was the habit in the Western left, a very, I think, corrosive habit. Yeah. Because it left the Western left with the ability to critique capitalism, but not offer an alternative. You know, the robust alternative was just not available. So for us at Tricontinental, we said that this novel coronavirus and COVID-19 has produced for us a concept, corona shock. What is corona shock? Corona shock, on the one side, is the demonstration that the advanced capitalist countries, the bourgeois order, has basically collapsed. Whether it's Italy, whether it's Brazil, United States, UK, India, these are the advanced capitalist countries, the bourgeois so-called democracies, they've all collapsed. They haven't been able to handle the coronavirus. But corona shock is not only their collapse, it's also the other side. How is it that Vietnam has had no fatalities? You know, Vietnam, the border of Vietnam is within a 10-hour bus ride from Wuhan City, the central city in Hubei province, from where apparently, so far as we know thus far, the coronavirus emerges. It might end up emerging in France. We don't know that. That's being looked at now.
California.
Then what will they say about that? You know, but for now, we think it's Wuhan. Nonetheless, there was an outbreak in Wuhan. 10-hour bus ride to Vietnam. They were able to stem the tide. In Kerala, the communist government stemmed the tide. Cuba, Venezuela. Why is it different? Because we believe, and we have started to analyze this, the four reasons why the corona shock occurred, why the bourgeois order collapsed, and why the socialistic parts of the world were able to tackle this. Four very simple things. Number one, the socialistic countries took a scientific attitude towards this virus. The bourgeois order took a hallucination attitude. You know, Boris Johnson was a hallucinatory attitude. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's not going to affect us, herd immunity. They don't know what they're talking about, you know. Second thing was, in the socialistic countries, there's the public sector. You can direct the public sector to make masks, make hand sanitizers, even make ventilators and so on. In the bourgeois countries, you can beg the profit sector. By the way, there's no private sector in the bourgeois countries. It's a profit sector. You're calling it a private sector actually gives it a certain dignity. It's a profit sector. You beg the profit sector, please make masks, please make hand sanitizers. They just can't do it, you know. Third point is public action. You know, in these socialistic countries, there are trade unions, women's organizations, youth groups. Millions of people go onto the street to provide relief for their fellow citizens. In China, the Communist Party deployed, neighborhood committees deployed. In Kerala, cooperatives deployed, women's groups, trade unions, and so on. In the advanced industrial, particularly North Atlantic countries, you've destroyed public action. You've made it, in a sense, illegal. You know, so yes, there are small groups of very well-meaning people doing mutual aid. You know, very good, important activity. But it cannot be scaled up, you know. Even in a small town in England, unless you can scale it up and get 2,000 people on the street, you know, in a, if the trade unions move, for instance, and say, we as the trade union are going to start providing food to people. But they don't. They don't have the habit of public action. So that's the third thing that differentiates the advanced industrial country from the socialist country. Fourth is internationalism. You know, Prime Minister Nguyen in Vietnam, and by the way, I would like people in the North Atlantic left to know his name. It's fine to know Prime Minister Ardern's name in New Zealand. She did a terrific job. She deserves every possible accolade. Very good job. But nobody knows Prime Minister Nguyen. This is a function of racism.
Interesting, isn't it?
You know, simple racism. No, it's just, come on, let's not be, let's not play around. It's actual active racism.
Yes, absolutely.
Pinarayi Vijayan is the chief minister of Kerala. Who knows the name Pinarayi Vijayan? I was so happy to see the Guardian newspaper, which generally is an execrable newspaper, horrible paper, did an excellent story. Excellent story on K.K. Shailja, the health minister of Kerala. Excellent
story. That was a great story.
They call it... Yeah. Yeah, coronavirus slayer. I thought that's a good story.
Yeah, I often defend the Guardian to Siam.
Well, it's, you know, it has its good side. And the person who wrote that story has written a terrific book on the 1918 flu pandemic. You know, she is a scholar, terrific book. So she knew how to write that story. I was very pleased with that story. So in these socialistic countries, like in Vietnam, Prime Minister Nguyen said, we will name no victims, no people who've died. We'll call them patient one, patient two, because we do not want to inflame xenophobia. You know, we don't want to create anti-Chinese sentiment. You know, we want to then send supplies, 440,000 pieces of protective equipment from Vietnam, a country bombed by the United States, was sent to the US. Meanwhile, the United States says China virus, Wuhan virus, Kung flu. I mean, good God, man, it's crudely racist and stupid. You know, it's juvenile to have things like that. That's a level of juvenileness that should not be tolerated. So one side of the world says, let us be in international solidarity. The other side says, let's be racist and jingoist. Man, the world is divided. Corona shock has shown us. I'm speaking now to the Western left. I'm telling you, You may raise your eyebrows and mock Vietnam and mock Kerala and mock Cuba and mock Venezuela. That's up to you. It's fine. But we have an analytic perspective to offer you. And I would like to have you criticize our concept, Corona Shock, robustly. I want you to show me how these are not socialistic society. I'm not calling it socialism or communism or utopia. This is an experiment. And brother, these experiments are taking place in the realm of necessity. If you want a perfect communism, you make your revolution in the realm of freedom and show us, teach us, but you're not doing it.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, we would be the first to criticize our comrades over here.
Yeah, I actually had a kind of a question that was related to the third point you were talking about, the habit of public action, because I noticed that, like, when I was reading your thing about China and the Corona Shock, that, you know, obviously in the West, the left and also the government enjoy, like, undermining the success of countries like China or Vietnam or Cuba in combating the virus by, you know, calling them authoritarian, whatever that means, saying that they're highly centralized. But so I thought it was really interesting that when you were talking about the responses in China, it was really focused on the idea of, like, it was like public health in a decentralized fashion, or like creative responses through decentralization, that in the UK people love to talk about, like, mutual aid and freedom and, like, decentralization and creativity, as opposed to what they think of as state socialism. So I just thought it was very interesting and also great to see, like, the response in countries like China and, like, Cuba and Vietnam and Kerala to be described in such terms as they are, which is community organizing, community mobilizing. Because again, I think also when we see, like, the news stories about, I don't know, like, however many hundreds of thousands of people have volunteered to do, like, mutual aid or, like, cooperative like work to combat the virus, that in the West is often dismissed in a very racist way as these people are just brainwashed or it's fake or it's not real. To take it seriously as, like, decentralized, creative, community, local organizing is very, it's very nice. It's very good. Yeah.
Well, look, you know, China suffers from a double penalty, which in a way the Russians didn't, because in a way the Russians could be seen as Europeans, although there is an anti-Slav thing that plays a role here. Let's not pretend that's not there. But China faces a double penalty. One is a very old penalty of, you know, it's an authoritarian, it's the yellow hordes, it's the, you know, Mongols, it's this, it's that, you know, it's the emperor on top and everybody kowtows to the emperor. You know, it's a crazy idea.
Yeah.
That has a very long, century-long history.
Yeah.
You mix that with the anti-communist idea that in a communist society, it's Mao and then everybody else just sort of bows to the Emperor Mao. In fact, in early depictions of Mao, he was portrayed as an old Chinese emperor. And these two things come together. And then if you are a journalist, a writer, or whatever, you can just pull out these racist and anti-communist tropes, you know, from your old dusty desk drawer, and you don't have to do any work. You don't have to actually go and say, how does one person, Xi Jinping, dominate 1.4 billion people? You know, how does that happen?
Yeah.
You know, it's obviously much more complicated than that. And if anybody actually goes to China and doesn't wear blinders, you know, sort of ideological racist and anti-communist dark glasses, and actually looks and sees, you will see that the provinces in China, it's hugely decentralized to provincial level. So the provinces actually run a lot of policy. You will see right down to neighborhood committees. I mean, I'm really quite stunned that in all the coverage on Wuhan, nobody really talked about neighborhood committees. I mean, my colleagues and I, when we wrote a series on which was then became the China and Corona Shock text that we produced, when we did our reporting, you know, I looked everywhere to see, has anybody written about the role of neighborhood committees? Well, nothing. You know, how do you feed people? You know, you can't give cash transfers. It doesn't work like that. Elderly people in their homes need medicine. Somebody has to go get the medicines. That's where the neighborhood committee came in. They volunteered. They knew who lives where. They have an understanding of their neighborhood. And so when you look at these countries, you know, Venezuela, highly decentralized development of social life, you know, the comunas, the missions, and so on. So it requires an enormous act of blindness not to see what's right in front of you. And that blindness in China, at least, is produced by a combination of racism and then laced with an enormous dose of anti-communism.
Yeah, I would agree.
Just to return to that excellent description of the English ruling class as kind of hallucinating, I found that particularly striking. Because I think there's many people over here, if you're a socialist, you already have to continually deal with your disbelief that most people that ever lived lives of unremitting, pointless toil. And currently, if you're a socialist in the UK, you have to deal with your disbelief that, you know, the leaders who the entire Toryfied press seems to cherish, like they'll say on camera, like, I went into a hospital and I shook everyone's hand. And then a few weeks later, they'll actually get coronavirus, and then the whole nation will be expected to pity them and give them a kind of preemptive state funeral. And like, it's kind of shocking that the level of chaos, like lies, you know, the willingness to murder, the constant confusion. There's just been so much dissembling over here at the same time as there's that constant racism towards China or Vietnam, these places that, you know, comparatively have done so much better than, you know, what is essentially a kind of what might have been called a failed state and an older kind of lingo over here. And I was wondering, just to hear your perspective a bit more and what's been happening in the UK and why it's been so particularly bad in like Anglo-America would be quite interesting.
Well, firstly, let's not start in 2020 or 2019. In 1955, M.S. Cesar wrote a text called Discourse on Colonialism. Yeah. It's a brilliant long text, essay, whatever it is. In the beginning of the text, he writes, a civilization that proves incapable of solving the problems it creates is a decadent civilization. Mm. Okay? A civilization that proves incapable of solving the problems it creates is a decadent civilization. I want you to take that line seriously. This is in 1955. He's talking about France. You see, he's actually talking about capitalist societies. But France is the direct target because the text is saying, listen, Europeans, this is 1955, 10 years after World War II has ended. Listen, Europeans, you are horrified by Hitler, but we have seen Hitler in the colonies. Mm. You know, Hitler was your colonial official. He's, you know, we are not surprised by Hitler. Hitler did to you what you have been doing to us. What did you do in the Congo? This is what Cesar writes. He says, a civilization that proves incapable of solving the problems it created is a decadent civilization. That's a very key line. This decadence has been there for a long time. Now the decadence has emerged to the surface. In other words, you see, it demonstrates this emergence of leaders like Boris Johnson demonstrate two things. One is the collapse of the middle road, the so-called third way, centrism, neoliberals, whatever. They have exhausted their agenda. They have nothing to offer people. You see that in the exhaustion. I mean, and the British Labour Party will never learn this lesson. They will continue to sit in the middle of the trough of Blairite, you know, third way politics. They will not learn this. They think that's the way to win elections. But that's okay. That's the hell that they will live in. The problem is, on the one side, it politically opens the door to the right. But what it also shows is that the ruling class is so incapable of solving any problems that it allows a decadence to set in where people like Boris Johnson and his coterie, you know, around him, they are not any less as hallucinatory. You know, they are in charge now. I mean, you know, a pure blood John Bull Englishman would say, how did we get here from Churchill? I would say Churchill was Boris Johnson. You just didn't see it at the time. You know, Churchill is the fruit of a decadent civilization. After all, he's a war criminal. The things he did in Pakistan, the things he did in Sudan, he was a war criminal. What he did to Bengal in 1943, you know, commissioning a famine where between 1 and 3 million people died. You know, Churchill was Boris Johnson.
Yeah.
They are not different, but you just didn't see it. Now you see it. It's on the surface. You've got to wake up and do something about it. You know, you have to overthrow this ruling class. Its decadence is an old decadence. The fact that they couldn't see what was coming is precisely what you'd expect them to do. You know, and then to masquerade or hide their own incompetence, they blame China.
Yeah.
You know, their incompetence must be blamed on somebody else. By the way, isn't it always like this with the kind of Bullingdon crowd of Boris Johnson? They break a vase in the living room and they say nanny broke it. You know, they break a teacup, they say the butler broke it. They don't take responsibility. They let the butler get sacked. I've read enough British fiction and watched enough British movies to know how this works.
Or they just throw money at
Boris Johnson just, you know, whizzes his beautiful blonde hair away and says, "Mummy, I didn't do it." And, you know, this is a case of Boris Johnson looking at the British people and saying, "Mummy, I didn't do it. Blame the immigrant, you know, blame the Chinese." Yeah. I mean, this is what the ruling class always does. They don't go to their parents and say, "I'm sorry, I broke the Ming vase." They don't take responsibility.
Yeah.
They have not taken responsibility for generations. So to now expect them to be competent, I think that's not only the hallucination of the ruling class and its leadership, but it's a hallucination of the British people.
Yeah.
Wake up, guys.
Yeah.
Yeah. The rot was definitely always within. As you say, the fact that there are still, like, you know, sensible commentators now saying, "Oh, Boris Johnson, he thinks he's Churchill. What a joke. He's not as grand or as great as our wartime leader Churchill. This perpetrator of mass genocide, like, you know, a continual destruction of peoples all over the world." And, you know, yeah, as you say, the hallucination is very powerful. I do want to draw you out a little bit on those comments about the Labour Party, because it's going through a kind of one of its perennial personality crises right now, with various kind of attempts at reform being discussed and various exposés about just how disgusting and rife certain kinds of attitude are within it, certainly certain kinds of kind of right-wing social liberal attitudes that you describe. But I'm wondering how you think the left might be placed, like, within or against the Labour Party here in the UK. I mean, it's particularly pertinent because obviously you and I first met at Oxford Transformed about a year ago. You know, a grassroots kind of momentum members organised thing, like local leftists all working together to put on a pretty good event, much like what had been put on around the country, because there was still this energy around Corbynism, this idea that you could have a kind of, you know, it's like the left's version of the third way, like not quite anarchist, not quite state communist, like something all about democratic participation, something about reviving the party form, but, like, you know, supposedly from below. But it was always thought that it was going to be a very long revolution. And, you know, fast forward almost a year, and here we are, the Labour Party completely decimated and the left's hopes and dreams really thrown against the rocks. And it seems like a very different world now. So I'd just be interested on what your thoughts are on what's happened with Labour and whether it really is, you know, the end for left participation in it.
I mean, look, I'm not well-versed in the minutiae of what Keir Starmer has said today and so on. I don't spend my time following, you know, the little parliamentary gives and takes. It's very charming and so on. But, you know, I've taken enough charm, British charm, I think, that I can tolerate. So watching them stand at, you know, I suppose that, is the parliament even in session? Are they meeting in Zoom room? What are those benches and yelling at each other across the internet? God knows. But the point I would like to make is that, you know, we are coming to a position globally where the issue of the reformist parties, let's call it that, the issue of these sort of middle of the road, milquetoast parties, we need to actually directly think about this. Now, what does it mean? The left has a tendency to veer into sectarianism and go away from, you know, the social democratic type parties. And I think that's a huge problem. We should not be sectarian. On the other hand, I think it's, in my opinion, that there needs to be a long-term left project that is not distracted from the everyday rhythms of parliamentary and electoral politics, a long-term left project to build the independent strength of the working class.
Yeah.
I think that's very important. It's fine to have a principled unity with the social democrats against the lunatics. I agree, of course. But that doesn't mean that you dissolve yourself into the social democrats. I think that's the issue.
Yeah.
is that the electoral systems in the North Atlantic states, so-called democracies, are constructed in such a way to force the left to provide its mass support to social democrats. That's the way the system is set up. It's a very clever system, you know. We should discuss it for what it is, you know. It's a kind of system that draws the power of the left, potential power of the left, into social democracy, and then you have to go with the agenda of social democracy. You don't build your independent strength.
Yeah.
So we need to have the independent strength. And I think, what if I am being, if I'm allowed to say, you know, one of the problems of the Corbyn experiment was that the left still didn't remain independent. The institutions that emerged independent of the Labour Party became instruments of Corbynism in the Labour Party. So Momentum and so on became instruments of Corbynism inside the party. You need to build independent strength, you know, so that then you can unite with, in a sense, on a principled basis, not unite on their basis.
Yeah.
I mean, the Labour Party is still controlled completely by the reformists. Even when Corbyn was the head of the party, in fact, the reformists controlled the institutions.
Yeah.
And which is why they made his life a living hell. And I think that, you know, you have what are independent pockets of strength backing you, but that's different from the independent strength of the working class. And, you know, why do you need the independent strength of the working class? Because, in fact, the working class might take a position that's different from Leave and Remain. You know, this Leave and Remain trap is a ruling class trap. What is the working class position on it? It may be different, but if you don't give working class institutions have time to generate an opinion, and you just come in, spit into people's faces and say, are you for Leave or Remain?
Yeah.
You know, this is a big problem, because Leave or Remain is not the way we want to frame the issue of Europe. Maybe you want to frame the issue of Europe in terms of a democratic building of democratic institutions, not Leave or Remain. It's a different question. Do you want your domination of, you know, the city of London, or domination of city of London and Brussels? You know, I mean, this is hardly a choice, you know. So the question that has to be on the table, and, you know, I don't have a strategy for you. This is not my bailiwick, as they say, it's not my thing. But what I would generally say is, in the North Atlantic left, the habit of building independent working class strength is gone. What you see in the left are people who sort of dragoon themselves into the reformist parties, believing they can build a left pole inside them and push the party to the left. And outside them, there are sectarians who say the whole thing is gone. I think both are totally wrong. I think you need to have a dialectical unity of those attitudes. You need to say, yes, we need to build our independent strength, but we are for principled unity with the Social Democrats. Not to say the Social Democrats always wrong, stay out, we'll be six of us standing there on the high street handing out our newspaper. That's a totally wrong attitude, but there's something correct in it, which is build the independent strength of the working class. But they don't do it. They've sectarianized themselves.
Yeah.
And on the other side, those who say go inside and work from within, they are also wrong, but there's something correct in it, which is principled unity. So that should be the attitude of the left. That is a 10, 15, 20 year project, friends. You can't do that in the middle of an electoral cycle.
Yeah.
Yeah. And certainly in terms of thinking about left power, it's never been more important, right? Like, we're in the middle of what the IMF and others have described as the Great Lockdown, their catchy term for the global economic crisis.
Yeah.
Where obviously so much of the world economy has kind of been mothballed or put into storage, but we know it's not going to come out pristine. It's going to come out either full of holes or almost completely deteriorated and have to kind of be reinvented. Many have tried to compare this to the Great Depression, or to a kind of the kind of exact opposite of a wartime economy, like a complete demobilization. But we know so much of this economic crisis was already built in. This is not just like the COVID economic crisis. This is the same crisis that has been snapping at the heels of global capital since 2008, 2009. So I was wondering what your analysis of the current economic crisis is, of the, you know, the economic depression that we're in. In order that, I think, for the left to act, it needs to understand how to take advantage of what's going on, and you know, have a strategy based on kind of that evolving economic situation, right?
mean, it's firstly, it's a very complicated business. We need to understand that maybe by the end of this, and who knows, it may end in the end of 2021, we don't know. By the end of this, about 3 billion, half the world's population are going to live in hunger. And that great hunger is something we have not seen at this scale. You know, already about 2.7 billion people are not able to find adequate employment. That's an enormous number. You know, it's not 50 million, 100 million, 300 million. You know, these are numbers that we are familiar with. 2.7 billion is just an outrageous number, unable to find employment. Now, the unable to find employment is not as important to me as that maybe 3 billion people will live in hunger. That is outrageous. You know, that we have to bang on consistently. We cannot allow the people who are able to make decisions in this world to forget that. You know, we cannot allow that. This big, great lockdown, it's a fantastic phrase. It's a felicitous phrase because if you look at the phrase, the great lockdown, in a way, this is the largest general strike that human beings have seen since the beginning of capitalism. It's the largest general strike. It's not a strike that the workers, you know, actively produced. It was imposed on society. But it has shown to people, at least on the surface, that labor makes surplus value, that labor produces good commodities which sell, and through their sale, wealth is produced. That has now been established. It may not be in those terms, but people understand that if you just take labor out, entrepreneurs can't make things happen. Labor is essential. It is also demonstrated that so-called essential workers are essential. You know, that essentialness with workers, it's important. For us on the left, the first task is these three points: hunger, the fact that labor is essential, and that this idea of essential workers has arrived. We need to make sure no amnesia sets in around these three things. This is our task in the battle of ideas. We have to bang on this very hard. This is the first point. Second point is, as far as global capitalism is concerned, they are using this great lockdown as an opportunity to test a platform society. Can we buy things off the web? Can we buy everything off the web? The more we are being, in fact, guinea pigged into learning how to become platform consumers even more than before. Of course, you bought things before, Amazon and so on. Now you buy everything. So let's the high street shops get wiped out. As you say in England, high street shop, wipe them out. Big chains can exist. You may not even have a big chain grocery store near your house, just a warehouse. You order online, the warehouse delivers to you. We may grow into platform societies increasingly. This is the second thing. Platform society means much more structural unemployment, you know, because small shops and so on are great hirers of people. If you wipe out all small shops, which is likely, they will be bankrupt at the end of this, we will move to a platform, basically a platform economy, you know, for a lot of consumer services. And I don't just mean goods purchases, even services purchases. You know, if you're going to do, it's already been there. If you want to hire somebody to do your taxes, you can already do it online. You don't need to do it. You don't need to go to the shop. Already travel agents have been wiped out. You know, this is earlier, a generation ago. They've been slowly wiped out. So many of the shops have disappeared to the platform. Now even more. Even more. Perhaps education will be on the platform. You know, perhaps more. I don't know if you have experienced telemedicine. We'll do medicine on the platform. You know, many things will shift to the platform. So the second thing is platform capitalism. Got to be very aware of this because it will create much deeper structural unemployment. But the third thing is, to my mind, equally important. You see, global supply chains have gone for a six. Global trade volumes are down by about 32%. That's an enormous decline. At the height of the Great Recession 10 years ago, it went down about 9%. Now it's gone down 32-35% maybe, you know, global trade volumes. That means goods are not moving around the world at the scale they used to. This doesn't mean that people will start to say, let's produce the goods in our own economy. We're not moving back to national economies. Labor in many countries is far too expensive. What will happen is the supply chain will be changed around. And this is part of the attack on China. Already the United States has made it clear that they want to detach from China as much as possible, move to India, move to Australia, move to Indonesia and so on, find other places to source, you know, partly finished goods or finished goods. Now, it's not going to be easy for them to pivot because Chinese labor is well educated, Chinese labor is, you know, is healthy, it's decently fed, much better than India. You see, problem in India is you can get labor at a low cost, but labor is suffers malnutrition. Labor suffers from ill health. So you can't get the kind of productivity you can get in place. So it's going to be hard to pivot. These are material issues. They are not just, you know, you're not playing a game of risk on a board. The quality of labor is different in different countries. So this third thing is going to be take us to the threshold of a kind of warlike conflict. I'm very worried about that. You know, the next newsletter we have coming out is an appeal for peace against war. Because this third issue, we are moving towards some limited military engagement. Limited military engagement. The Iranians will face some American engagement. The Venezuelans will face some American. You know, the Chinese will face some. Neither Iran, Venezuela, or China want a war. The United States is trying to impose a war to re-inscribe its hegemony on the planet. This third part, how the global commodity change, this is very worrying to me.
Yeah, that's also been on my mind a lot. And I think it really, this thing, especially the third point about war, to thinking about not only what the left can do in general, but what, in terms of internationalism, what a left in, for example, where we are in the UK, a cursed place, might have to do in terms of what you're talking about, the prospect of war, and of our countries, the UK, the USA, trying to make war on, like, Iran and Venezuela and China. So I guess I was wondering, both in that sense and also in a more general sense, I guess, what is the future of internationalism?
Yeah, so, I mean, look, I mean, for people on the left, internationalism is not an empty word. You know, solidarity should not be an empty word. It has become an empty word. And partly that's because, again, I'm sorry, I'm really sort of taking it out on the North Atlantic left with you.
Oh, we don't mind.
I don't mean to. I hate the North Atlantic left.
I don't mean to focus on this. But there is a way in which the North Atlantic left has, you know, understands its international view in a kind of consumer way. You know, you say, well, I like Chavez, I don't like Maduro. You know, it's a matter of one kind of cereal versus another, or one kind of bread versus another. You know, I like Mao, but I don't like Xi Jinping, or I like this, I don't like that. I mean, okay, I get it. You may have some personality issues with somebody. That's not relevant to me. The question is, how do you understand the nature of the international class struggle? What are they doing in Venezuela? You know, what are they doing? I mean, they are trying to preserve their resources. That's important. That's what the government, the socialist government in Bolivia, was trying to do. They were trying to preserve Bolivian resources, lift up the Bolivian people, do a kind of resource socialism. It's what it is. I mean, you don't have huge wealth in that society. If you're going to lift up the people of the society, you're going to have to use the resources. Fine, somebody will have a critique of extractivism, you know, the earth is being destroyed. I get it. There's place to have a debate there. But the fact of the matter is, these governments, these projects, were not saying, come here, Barrick Gold, take our wealth and make a profit in Canada. They are saying, we are going to take care of our people. That's how I understand the international class struggle. They took a different position, you know, than what the United States of America wants to take. So then the question isn't, what is your personal opinion about Venezuela? I actually don't care about your personal opinion. I'm interested in, how do you understand the international class struggle? And in one society, you see that the people in general are behind a project which is struggling to walk. You know, forget running, forget sprinting. It's struggling to walk. It's not easy to construct socialism when you're under such immense attack. They are trying to construct a project. On the other side, you have the United States trying to destroy that project. That's an international class struggle. I see that as a flashpoint in the class struggle. At Tricontinental, we are producing a document, should come out in about 12, 13 days, called Corona Shock and the Hybrid War Against Venezuela. It'll try to assemble everything the United States has done against Venezuela in the last 3 or 4 months, you know, from tightening up the sanctions at the beginning of the coronavirus pandemic. It's incredible. I mean, this pandemic is going on and they're tightening the attempt to overthrow the government. So now, you see, you come at this and say, well, you know, I don't want war, but I don't like the government in Venezuela. I'm sorry, it doesn't work like that. You know, if you cannot have solidarity in an empty way. You know, I personally am not a religious person. I'm a Marxist. I don't believe in religion's place in the world. So I don't accept many of the attitudes of the Iranian government. You know, I'm not for a theocratic type of government. But I will defend that government's right against an attack by the imperialists 100%. I won't, in the middle of the defense, say, well, I have some problems, so let's take this opportunity to change the government. That is an outrageous attitude. You know, that's like when the British scholar Fred Halliday said about Saddam Hussein's government, he said that, well, that government is fascist, so we can back the imperialists against the fascists. Are you crazy? That government was a horrible government. Saddam Hussein was a brutal chap. But it's not international fascism, you know, Hitler in Baghdad, that you then need to support the whole US war machine to destroy it. You destroy a country, Fred. That's not an attitude. That's a false analogy. You know, I defended the people of Iraq against the imperialist war, not because I think Saddam Hussein is like, you know, a great leader of the future. You know, he was butchered more friends of mine, communists in Iraq, than I'd care to imagine. You understand? But nonetheless, solidarity means that you have to stand against war. You can't waffle about saying, well, neither this nor that. You see, it's a classic position taken by many parties of the Fourth International and so on. You know, they always say, I'm neither this nor that. I don't like the imperialists. I don't like the government in Syria. What happens, of course, is in the end of the day, they support the imperialists against the government in Syria. If you actually don't like both, then don't like both. But they actually end up supporting the government. So all people of this tendency, the Fourth International type tendency with Libya, I don't like Gaddafi, I don't like the US government, imperialism, but in the end of the day, they'll support the war against Gaddafi's government in Libya. Now, if you don't like both, then you don't like both. That's different. Why are you supporting one against the other? That means you prefer one to the other. You see, so now which one did you prefer? You preferred the imperialists. So take your stand in the class struggle. You see, I might not like the Gaddafi government in Libya, but I know where to take my stand in the class struggle. I will oppose a war against Libya by the imperialists. You see, so that's what I mean by internationalism, solidarity. We have to learn these habits. You know, it's not about consumer choice and, you know, I like this, I don't like that. Or it's not about having an enduring secret racist faith in Western power. You know, believing the end of the day, the West is doing things for the most noble intentions. This creeps in. You know, this is there because they have ideological hegemony. End of the day, you say, well, you know, I don't like the Americans, but if NATO is bombing, that's okay. Because after all, it's the French, you know, they gave you Jean-Paul Sartre and so on. You'll forget the Algerian War, you'll forget Vietnam, all that stuff. You'll say, well, they are French, they're sophisticated. You know, forget the fact that Sarkozy is exact definition of decadence, you know, that M.S. Azhar talked about.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think taking a zero-tolerance stand against war and for peace, and also making sure people decide where they stand in the class struggle is, yeah, as you say, cannot be more important right now. I would say it's a very poignant note to conclude on as well. I would urge all our listeners to sign up to the Tricontinental newsletter.
Yeah.
But what are the other ways they should follow your work and the other projects that you're involved in? I know you recently became involved in the Progressive Internationale, right? This new, I don't know, is it a kind of forum or a new kind of global political project?
Well, I'll tell you about four different things. How's that? And that's actually the best
yeah,
way
yeah.
To, for us to conclude. The first is I'm a chief editor of a publishing house in Delhi called Leftward Books, and it's at leftward.com, where I'm bringing out a book in 2 months called Washington Bullets, which is mm-hmm. essentially a short history of U.S. imperialism. And it's
right,
about
like
120
song.
Pages. It's like, it's exactly the Clash song.
Which is also
so
a short history
first,
of American imperialism.
Yeah.
Which is also, I have some, of course, some problems with my comrades in the Clash with that song, but by and large, I quite agree with their sentiment.
And the music slaps, some, yeah, critical support for the Clash.
Some general, some one or two issues we may disagree, but it's a superb band and that's a great song. And it's a great title for a song, which I'm stealing. So that's Leftward Books. And the second thing is I'm a chief correspondent of Globetrotter, which is a syndicated column service. And, you know, we're expanding Globetrotter. We're going to have more voices writing for it. And I really, and, you know, you can't actually, there's a Globetrotter website, but that's not the place to read us. We are syndicated. Yeah. So, you know, I think you should tell Morningstar to carry all the Globetrotter columns, for instance. I leave that up to you. So that's the second thing. Third thing is I'm the Tricontinental is part of a project called the International People's Assembly, which is 200 political organizations, including the Communist Party of Nepal, Workers' Party of Tunisia, the Landless Workers' Movement of Brazil, Socialist Party of Zambia, and so on. And we are spread out over 100 countries. And that's a project that's been built for many years. It's a long-term, working-class-led internationalist project. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we have an event called the a Week of Struggle Against Imperialism. You can check it out online, antiimperialistweek.org. Mm-hmm. And that's going to happen this year. You know, so there's that. That's the third thing. The fourth thing, I'm involved in the Progressive International, which is, I don't know exactly how it will shape up because the council hasn't met yet. Mm-hmm. It was to meet in Reykjavik in Iceland in September of 2020. We don't know what's going to happen, but it's an initiative spearheaded by Yanis Varoufakis and Srećko Hovat of DM25, Democracy in Europe 25. You see, I'm in favor of all kinds of platforms such as this, and we all need to work together because the left is weak. And, you know, principled unity of people of the left is extremely important in this time. And, you know, there's no sense in having a false unity. There's no sense in being divided. That's why I use the phrase principled unity. Mm-hmm. That's the only way to go.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. I couldn't concur more. All right. Right.
Thank you so much, Peter. Yeah.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Oh, mama, mama, look there. The children are playing in the street again. Don't you know what happened down there? A youth of 14 got shot down there. The cocaine guns jammed downtown. The killing clowns, the blood money men. The shooting foes. Washington bullets again. As every cell in Chile will tell. The cries of the tortured men. Remember Allende and the days before. Before the army came. Please remember Victor Jara. In the Santiago